on the show today, the hidden forces that shape our habits and choices every day, including the way we behave around other people, social norms.
Culture is this really interesting puzzle because it's omnipresent. It's all around us 24/7, but it's invisible. We don't really think about it. We take it for granted.
This is Michelle Gelfand. She is a cross-cultural psychologist.
And I try to do research to uncover the hidden cultural codes that guide our behavior. Really what we call social norms, these unwritten rules for what's expected of us in everyday settings. And, you know, we're constantly following rules. We just don't really realize it.
Over the past three decades, Michelle has published over 150 papers in academic journals, including one in particular that became, well, a hit. It was published in the journal Science in 2011. The study examined cultural norms in over 30 countries around the world, and it became the basis for Michelle's book, Rulemakers, Rule Breakers, How Tight and Loose Cultures Wire Our World.
In some contexts, the rules are very strict. They're what we call tight cultures. They have a lot of rules and a lot of reliable punishments when people violate them. On the flip side, we have contexts where there are looser norms, where there's a wider range of behavior that's perceived as permissible.
What we found was that just like we can classify people in terms of their personalities, we can also classify groups in terms of the strength of their norms.
Here's Michelle Gelfand on the TED stage.
So tight-loose is a continuum. Some groups like Japan and Singapore, Austria and Germany veer tight. Other groups like New Zealand or Brazil, Greece or the Netherlands veer loose. And what we found was that tight and loose confers really important trade-offs for groups that we don't recognize. So tight groups have the corner on order. They have a lot more law enforcement and also security, and they have much less crime. Tight cultures with their strong rules have people also regulating their behavior more. They have more self-control. Tight cultures have less alcoholism, they have less debt, and they're less fat. Loose cultures tend to be more disorganized. They have more crime. They have less synchrony, and they have a host of self-regulation failures. But loose cultures corner the market on openness. They're far more open to many different types of people, people from different religions, from races, immigrants, people with disabilities, many stigmatized people. In one experiment I did, I asked my research assistants from all over the world to wear fake facial warts, tattoos, and nose rings. And they were asking for help on city streets or in stores. And there was a very clear pattern. People in loose cultures were much more likely to get helped when they were wearing these stigmas as compared to tight cultures. Loose cultures are also open to more ideas. They're much more creative, and they're much more open to change. And tight cultures struggle with openness. So you might be asking by now, what causes these differences? Tight and loose cultures don't share any obvious characteristics, geography or language or religion or tradition. But there is a hidden rationale, and it has to do with threat.
When cultures have a lot of chronic threat in their histories, you can think about threat from Mother Nature, like constant natural disasters or famine, or they have a lot of human-made threat. Think about how many times your nation's been potentially invaded over the last several hundred years. When you have a lot of threat, you need rules to coordinate to survive. And the idea is that loose cultures might have had less threat and that can afford more permissive norms. Because if there's less coordination needs, then you don't need to have tighter norms.
You know, I always get worried about being like, oh, you know, Germany, they're rigid there. You know, nobody crosses the street, even if there's no cars coming, if it's not green. And my question to you is like, is this a case of science proving the stereotypes in some way? You know, Berlin, actually quite a freewheeling city, except I lived there and it was true. No one crosses the street if there's no traffic coming. So I guess I'm curious, like, how do you sort of parse what is a stereotype that people have versus what the science tells you?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And, you know, every culture has tight and loose elements. If we zoom into different domains, we could see, in Germany, there's strict rules on time and on jaywalking. But, you know, then you see people going, you know, having more nudity at beaches, which you wouldn't see in the U.S. The U.S. has strangely, like a domain of sexuality is a little tighter here.
Yeah.
Even though we have a lot of looseness when it comes to jaywalking, I can attest to that. You know, my home, New York State, New York City, it's really dangerous. You know, and so the point here is that we can place countries on a continuum, but we need to remember that it's dynamic, it can change, and that we can zoom in and we can find domains in every culture that are tight and loose and try to understand why they are the way they are.
In a minute, Michelle Gelfand explains how the tight-loose framework can help explain differences on a personal level, too, within our families, friendships, and relationships. On the show today, the hidden forces that shape our lives. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Stay with us. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. Today on the show, the hidden forces that shape our lives. We were just talking to cross-cultural psychologist Michelle Gelfand. Michelle says that some cultures veer tight, meaning they have stricter rules and norms, while others veer loose. And she believes this framework can help us understand our differences.
Rather than red or blue, we can also differentiate our United States, 50 states, in terms of a continuum of tight and loose. In our research, we could see the South and some parts of the Midwest veer tight, and the coasts tend to veer loose. Tight states, just like tight nations, tend to have more threat. There's a remarkable similarity between scores on tightness in our data and Mother Nature's fury in terms of natural disasters. Once you grasp the tight-loose lens, you can also use it to analyze other differences that have eluded us. Let's take social class. In our research, the working class is far tighter than the upper class, and it makes sense. They experience a lot of threat. It's the upper class that has more of a safety net. They have less threat, and so they can afford to be more rule breakers.
And is that partly because, like, if you don't have to worry about having health care and, you know, all those other things, like a huge load is lifted off your shoulders and you can think about the world differently. You can move more freely.
Bingo. One of our studies that we did that it was the youngest people in our samples. They were 3-year-olds, kids between 3 and 5 years old. We brought them into the lab and we can't exactly ask them how tight or loose is your household, the three, you know. But we have these kids playing a new game with a puppet, Max the puppet. In the middle of the experiment, Max the puppet does something a little strange. She starts violating the rules of the game. And, you know, we simply actually look at what do the kids do? Like, do they laugh at Max? Do they tell him to stop? But we wanted to see, does this vary by class? Like, are there working class kids more likely to tell Max to stop as compared to the upper class kids? And in fact, we have some evidence that that seems to be the case, that this starts early. So this is just another way to think about tight loose, this invisible pattern in a different level of analysis.
You're reminding me, I had a conversation with my brother the other day about my niece, who is like maybe not the like most athletic kid on the playground. And he was saying, you know, she really wants kids to follow the rules because then things are predictable, right? Like she's not hanging around on the monkey bars like some of those other kids who are crazy. So I guess I wonder about that too. You know, in every situation, depending on your limitations, you veer towards tightness or looseness.
Yeah, that's right. And actually very interesting. I mean, parents, teachers, prime socializers of cultures. So you can even analyze school systems for how tight or loose they are.
Uh-huh.
How do you design schools that have a healthy amount of accountability, but also empowerment from looseness? So parents are socializing what they think is the right balance in their households with their kids. Then schools are reinforcing this.
Yeah.
So we all have our own story. I think what's exciting is to figure out where do our own mindsets come from, whether it's from our socialization, whether it's from our occupation, our gender, our culture. How has it changed over time? And then we can think about, is it optimal? Do we have the optimal balance?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to know, like, how do you teach openness to somebody who veers more closed? Like, do you do it with rules? Like, you must be open and not punish anyone?
Well, you know, we might call that legislative looseness, right? Uh-huh, there's places and times where you're allowed to be loose. You know, this is a very personal question because, you know, I have a quiz that assesses our tight and loose mindset and ask people to think about themselves in general, like in your life. Do you like rules? Do you try to manage your impulses? Do you like structure? Do you like predictability? On the flip side, do you take risks? Are you someone that's tolerant of a lot of uncertainty? Are you someone who is a little more impulsive? You know, these are kind of things that we ask people to think about. And by the way, you could think about it in general, or you can ask yourself at work. You know, you can ask those questions in your work life. Is this, you know, how do you think about rules and impulse control and structure? In your social life, do you have a different mindset? So you can think about this in various different contexts too. The quiz itself asks people to think about it generally. And then you get a score, which is combining these variables. And, you know, you can think about someone who gets a score of very loose, moderately tight, or very tight.
I took it.
You took it. What was your score?
I'm moderately loose.
You are. Okay.
And I said that to my producer and she was like, of course you are. You always want to break the rules.
Wow. That's really interesting. So it helps us to A, understand ourselves and also be able to communicate with people around us with greater empathy. So I score moderately loose on my own quiz. My husband's a lawyer. That dude is very tight, right? He actually, we've been married for 30 years and you know, we made it work, but like he gets deeply disturbed by how I load the dishwasher. And so, you know, he is in a context, an occupation where there's a lot of accountability. He has to have his time, like, you know, accounted for every 6 minutes.
Well, you're making me think of my kids where I know one, I think, would score quite loose. The other would score quite tight. And I shift, you know, I code switch between the two of them, encouraging one of them to go a little looser and the other to go tighter, just to balance them out a little.
Yeah, that's totally right. And in fact, that's a kind of an ambidexterity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my daughters will say, look, in our household, the norms that are tight have to do with basically respect. Like we need to work hard. We need to take care of our health. But the looser domains that they also know are like, you know, their rooms, how messy they are. We just close the door, you know, their curfew. They've always had a very lax curfew because we say, look, you need to be accountable to yourself. So we're not going to legislate that. As we zoom into any level, like whether it's organizations or households or relationships, we can start being intentional about where we want tight and loose norms, and we can negotiate it. And that's how we help people to kind of pivot and have more ambidexterity.
This is what I call the Goldilocks principle of tightness and looseness, that we need a balance of the strength of norms in our everyday lives for the maximal happiness. So I want to leave you with a few different ideas of how you can use the tight-loose code in your everyday life. The first is that we should understand our own mindsets. We each have a certain default on the tight-loose spectrum based on our own personal experiences. The second is that we need to cultivate empathy for others' mindsets. Often people that we have a lot of conflict with are people that we have the biggest differences in our tight-loose mindsets. And understanding where they come from can be great to understand and empathize and build better relationships. And finally, we can harness the power of social norms to better our world. Culture isn't destiny. We can tighten up norms when they're getting too loose or loosen up norms when they're getting too tight. Luckily for us, humans developed and invented social norms, and we can use them to better our planet. Thank you.
That was Michelle Gelfand. She is a professor of organizational behavior at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. You can see her full talk at TED.com. So we've talked about all kinds of different hidden forces in our lives, and that needs to include how we get around. In 2023, the U.S. Census estimated that around 70% of U.S. workers commuted by car in places like Phoenix, Arizona.
You know, 25 miles each way, hour and a half in traffic.
Ignacio Delgadillo used to spend a lot of time in his car because Phoenix is one of the least walkable cities in the United States. Its sprawling suburbs and wide streets are great for cars, not so much for pedestrians.
We really didn't talk to our neighbors. We don't really know. Like we say hi and bye as we're driving by, right? And then we just all go in straight into our garage.
But about a year ago, Ignacio and his family moved to a community designed to be car-free, cul-de-sac in Tempe, Arizona. Here, the streets are built for foot traffic. Buildings are close together. Trees line narrow walkways. A plaza with shops and restaurants serves as a town square.
You naturally see people all day, like, doing what they're doing, right? They're going to work, they're going to school, or they're just out enjoying their walk.
However much of a driving or car-dependent city you may happen to be in, there's a certain number of people who, when presented with the opportunity, will live car-free, and that market is completely unmet.
This is urban planner Jeff Speck. We talked to Jeff last year about his lifelong goal to make American cities more walkable. And he says that cul-de-sac Tempe is a great example of how neighborhoods can be transformed, and that the benefits go well beyond just meeting your neighbors.
Traffic safety, community identity, tourism, stormwater management, transit effectiveness, urban competitiveness. It reduces obesity, other chronic diseases, healthcare costs, crime, traffic congestion, maintenance costs, fossil fuel dependence.
But he also says making cities more walkable takes very careful planning, with seemingly invisible design choices that prioritize the needs of people over the needs of cars.
What that means at a deeper level is to create an environment in which people will make the choice to walk or to bike or to use some other form of micromobility rather than driving. And to do that, according to my general theory of walkability, the walk has to satisfy four basic criteria. It needs to be useful, it needs to be safe, it needs to be comfortable, and it needs to be interesting. And each one of those criteria then places upon us a series of mandates that surround urban design and city planning, my profession, to create that environment for the potential pedestrian or cyclist.
Okay, so to be walkable, a city needs to do those four things. They need these attributes for every walk a person takes. Let's start with the first. The walk needs to be useful. What do you mean by that?
So useful has to do with the proper mix of uses, so places to live, work, shop, recreate, all within walking distance. It typically means more housing in your downtown, which would balance the uses in your downtown and have it be active around the clock. When a neighborhood, which is principally a business district, becomes a truly mixed-use district with the proper balance of jobs and housing, it comes to life.
Okay, so we've made our city, we've made our walk useful. Now we need to make walking safe. How?
So the typical American street is designed for speeds well over the posted limit. And that's the exact opposite of what they do in the Netherlands, for example, where you make the streets as tight as they need to be to cause the drivers to go the speed that is safe for the community. The resistance that you find to accomplishing this typically lies in public works departments and engineering departments, which are led by engineers who still embrace the older concept of traffic safety, which in America grew out of highway safety. So if you think about yourself when you're driving on a highway where your speed is a constant, anything you can do to reduce opportunities for conflict, to increase elbow room, is going to make that street safer. So wider lanes, one-way traffic, no parallel parking, no trees, you know, that's the clear zone, you know, big swooping curves, all those things make a highway safer. But it's precisely the opposite that makes a downtown safe. You want to have narrow lanes, you want to have parallel parking, you want to have two-way traffic, you want to have lots of intersections and lots of other things going on. And so the biggest impediment often in cities to making them safe and comfortable to walk around is a traffic engineer who is trained on highway design and has brought it into city design.
Okay, our walk is useful, our walk is safe. How do we make it, number three, comfortable for walking?
Comfortable is the most designy aspect of the discussion because, and it's a little counterintuitive, we like to be in places that have spatial definition. If you can picture Lower Manhattan or, you know, the cranky parts of our oldest cities, those have the smallest blocks of all. And that gets us into the comfortable walk and that delightful feeling of being embraced by buildings on both sides.
Yeah.
So that idea of spatial definition is central to making walkable places. And we, you know, our favorite streets tend to be quite narrow. And then the buildings aren't that tall, but they're considerably taller than the streets are wide.
And that brings us to the fourth and final principle of making a city walkable, which is that the walk needs to be interesting.
Yeah. So the final category of interesting is basically not having blank walls, not having parking structures, having lots of eyes on the street in the form of doors and windows and signs of human activity. You know, we humans are among the social primates. Nothing interests us more than other humans. And that's what causes us to walk.
So when you arrive at a city to work with them, do you find that you need to first sort of change their cultural outlook on how to provide the best thing for their citizens? Is there a mind shift that you have to get them to do before you actually start talking about the details?
Well, I think what's different now as opposed to 10 years ago, or even certainly 30 years ago when I started doing this work, is that there's now an openness within public works departments and engineering departments to this information. And the thing that has evolved the fastest is bicycle infrastructure.
Hmm.
And when we're building new projects now, we're mandated by the city to not have the bike lane in the street. The new standard is to put it up on the sidewalk edge.
I mean, you're speaking to number two, a safe walk or a safe ride in this case on a bicycle. But we've been hearing so many headlines about the rise in pedestrian and, I believe, biker deaths. Mm-hmm. So if more cities are becoming more welcoming to walking and riding bikes, why is this happening?
So more cities are getting more serious about improving pedestrian safety, but that's really just starting to kick in at volume now. And it used to be that, you know, the poor people lived in the inner city and the wealthy people were suburbanizing. Now, many more of America's poor are living further and further from the city center in order to afford a mortgage. That's where a lot of people are stuck now. And sadly, they're stuck there without cars, many of them.
Mm-hmm.
So you have kind of the double whammy of people living without cars in an environment that was designed without ever imagining people living there using it without cars.
Mm.
And I should say, when I joined this movement in the 80s, I really thought we could stop sprawl. I've pretty much given up on that goal after 40 years. But I've replaced it with a new goal, which is essentially to offer the walkable quality of life, you know, the walking lifestyle to as many more Americans as possible. And that's why, you know, I'm going where the people are and doing much more downtown work. And most of my work is for cities who call me in and say, you know, we realize that we could be so much better if we made our downtown more walkable. And what are the steps to getting there?
That was urban planner Jeff Speck. He's the author of Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. You can watch his TED Talks at TED.com and hear more from Jeff in our episode, A More Walkable World. Thank you so much for listening to our show. This episode was produced by Hersha Nahada, Rachel Faulkner-White, Katie Monteleone, and Kai McNamee. It was edited by Sanaz Meshkinpour, Katie Monteleone, and me. Our production staff at NPR also includes James Delahousie, Fiona Guerin, and Matthew Cloutier. Our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our audio engineers were Gilly Moon, Becky Brown, Jimmy Keeley, and Simon Jensen. Our theme music was written by Ramtin Arablouei. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Roxanne Highlash, Alejandra Salazar, and Daniela Balarezzo. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you've been listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.